Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Catastrophe in Haiti this week. Bank executives and bonuses in the spotlight and media battles from Google and China to late-night TV. On Tuesday, a 7.0 magnitude earthquake leveled Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince. By week's end, aid was slow in coming and desperate Haitians roamed the streets.
There's no help, no hospital, no electricity, nothing. No food, no water, nothing. There's too many people dying.
Big bank CEOs on Capitol Hill. Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission Chairman Phil Angelides went after the record of Goldman Sachs.
It sounds to me a little bit like selling a car with faulty brakes and then buying an insurance policy on the buyer of those cars. It doesn't seem to me that that's a practice that inspires confidence in the market.
And while Jay Leno and Conan O'Brien squared off over late night, Sarah Palin joined Fox News.
I'm so appreciative of the opportunity to get to work with you and the other team members here at Fox News to provide the fair and the balanced reporting and analysis that voters in this country deserve.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. Is the world doing right by Haiti? Are you tracking the Wall Street bonus numbers? Was Harry Reid out of bounds when he talked about Barack Obama? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is Zanny Minton-Beddoes. She's global economics editor for The Economist magazine. Zanny, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Also with us from Albany, New York, is Deborah Dickerson, contributing writer for Mother Jones. Deborah, great to have you back as well.
Fun to be here.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Zanny, and Deborah.
We'll hear sound from all over in this hour, but first, just to go straight to Haiti, Deborah Dickerson, I mean, your sort of deepest thoughts on what we've seen this week. There's a disaster, a calamity, the beginnings of a relief effort we'll talk about, but above all, the reality, the images and reality of a nation absolutely struck a terrible blow.
And one that... there are few nations that could have afforded this kind of blow less than Haiti, and I don't just mean financially in terms of their infrastructure and where they were before. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, tragedy struck Disneyland, which would be bad, but it was already such a place with so many problems. It's painful to watch the visual coverage, but, you know, I think all of us need to force ourselves to do that. Bodies rotting in the street, all these sorts of things. It's like Katrina, really, and it's just really, really hard to absorb what some people have to survive. And of course, there's no upside, but the only good thing is watching the world come together and try to do something about it, of course, with the usual naysayers.
Yes, there is some of that, but more just an effort to help. Zanny Minton-Beddoes, give us whatever international perspective you can here. This is right off the coast of Florida. All America is absolutely fixated on this. China, with its own recent earthquake history, sent folks in a hurry. But what about beyond? Is the whole world looking at Haiti now?
Oh, absolutely. I think the magnitude of the human tragedy is such that the whole world is watching completely shocked, and it's, as Deborah said, it's terrible to watch the pictures. I think what's really, really gnawing at people is the dissonance between the absolute desperate need, immediate need of people in Haiti, and the inability, despite all the will and desire to get people there, get aid there, to get enough through. And it's not that the rest of the world isn't responding. The rest of the world is responding massively. But because Haiti, as a result of being such a poor, relatively dysfunctional country, the infrastructure that there was, and there wasn't very much of it, has collapsed. And so there's this bottleneck. You cannot get the aid supplies in. You cannot get the people in fast enough because there's one airport, which is, you know, one small airstrip that's completely overwhelmed. The port is enough of the port is broken that's not very functional. And so you have, as you always have after earthquakes, a desperate race against time because you have very little time in which you can really save lives and prevent, you know, the onset of disease. And you have it much, for all the effort outside to get help in, there's this terrible and excruciating bottleneck.
Absolutely. And now with modern media, we see Haitians suffering as they wait somehow for that bottleneck to be cleared. Here was Secretary of State Hillary Clinton on NBC's Today Show. This is yesterday, saying the U.S. is committed to helping Haiti's earthquake victims.
We're going to do everything we can with our resources. The 82nd Airborne is getting to Haiti today. The aircraft carrier Carl Vincent will be on the horizon soon. The Coast Guard has performed magnificently in helping to evacuate the injured, particularly American citizens. So we have a full court press going on here at the president's direction.
A full court press, but it's not there yet. It hasn't arrived. It's not on the ground. Hunger and thirst and the dead in the streets and the trapped who remain. Jack Beatty, this is here's a country that fought for its independence way back 1804. Slaves overthrew the French. They paid dearly for that. Europe turned its back on Haiti for a long time afterward. But in the 20th and in this century, this country cannot seem to catch a break.
It cannot. And, you know, with Porfirio Diaz of Mexico, the Haitians might well say, so far from God, so close to the United States of America, because it's been their fate to be so close to us and to have suffered continually from our meddling, from our impositions of government there, from decades-long U.S. support of dictators there, torturers, in the name of anti-communism. Haiti, among other things, is a monument to that long-running failure called U.S. foreign policy. It puts us under a peculiar moral obligation to these people and to this country. And the president has, I think, spoken out of the heart of America when he said we're going to do everything. But everything may be a work of years, a commitment of years, a commitment of not hundreds of millions, but scores of billions of dollars. And now we have ourselves, you know, we are responsible for nation building in perhaps the poorest country in Asia, in Afghanistan, and probably now the poorest one in our hemisphere, Haiti. And the question is, where is this money going to come from? And will the president step up to the challenge by asking for more taxes eventually to pay for these things? Or will all this just be put on the credit card? And more than that, what will be the political ramifications of this for the president? That's a small part of this, but nevertheless, it's there. You know, the country may not be in a giving vein, given the hardships here. So a lot of imponderables.
The president talking very big on Haiti this week. Speaking yesterday at the White House, President Obama promised quick, thorough, huge response.
The losses that have been suffered in Haiti are nothing less than devastating. And responding to a disaster of this magnitude will require every element of our national capacity. Our diplomacy and development assistance, the power of our military, and most importantly, the compassion of our country.
Every element of our national capacity. Deborah Dickerson, do you hear that as a promise, as an over-promise?
It certainly sounds like a promise. Is it an overpromise? We'll see once we tie whatever long-term specifics we're talking about to that. It's part of me thrills to hear that, and part of what I plan to talk about today. But having heard it, as a citizen who's going through as rough a time as anybody else in this economy, I'm kind of going, exactly what does he mean by that? But then the citizen of the world, the citizen of this hemisphere, you know, is trying to find some balance. I think it hurts us to have a nation as poor and as relatively dysfunctional in our neighborhood as Haiti, and I think it behooves us, it should have behooved us for the last couple hundred years. I do think we should massively invest in Haiti in a sensible way, not here's a couple billion dollars, go wild, but something like a local type Peace Corps thing. But that would require political stability in Haiti. It would require real democracy. It would require real work, a real joint program to do what they can on their end to even make it safe for Americans to be there doing aid and nation building and teaching and that sort of thing. But I would absolutely, it's long past time that we treated Haiti like the neighbor that it is. But obviously it's got to be sensible and it's got to be physically safe.
It would take a lot, not to mention political support, in a country that's got a lot, you know, devastated, though not earthquake devastated, but a lot of economic devastation of its own. Let me get a call right here. Mike in Waterloo, Iowa. Mike, you're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
One of your people there said something about how we have a moral obligation, and while I agree with that, I think the president should be somewhat careful with saying that, setting expectations possibly too high, when we said we're going to use every power, of our country or whatever to help this country. We do have a moral obligation, but I think there's a risk to setting the standards too high. And I guess on top of that, one last comment, I'd like to say that the comments by Rush Limbaugh and Pat Robertson, I think, are kind of deplorable considering the situation. I don't think it's an American, I think it's an American issue, not a Republican or Democratic issue.
Mike, we'll come back. We'll look at those comments. We'll look at the long term. In the short term, Zanny, a lot of people are wondering why isn't there water already in the streets of Port-au-Prince? Why isn't there some more food? It's so close to Florida. Is it taking too long, Zanny?
Yeah, it's taking a long time because there is this terrible bottleneck of not being able to. You've got to be able to get stuff in there, and that's extremely difficult when you have one airstrip and a port that's not working very well. I think for the next week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, these bottlenecks are going to be a huge problem, and I think we need to kind of think of the way of helping Haiti in two phases. There's this first immediate acute phase where time is absolutely of the essence. But then I think Deborah is right that this is a country that was very fragile before, quite dysfunctional in many ways, that's now been completely devastated. It's had its infrastructure totally wrecked. The government is not working at all. It's got no viable army police force.
Zanny, hold the list there. We've got to take a short break. We'll come right back to it. Zanny Mittenbeddoes, Deborah Dickerson, and Jack Beattie. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news this hour, earthquake in Haiti, bankers in the spotlight at home. Zanny Mittenbeddoes is with us from The Economist, Deborah Dickerson from Mother Jones. Jack Beattie's here. Let's listen to some more sound around the Haiti catastrophe this week. Here's UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon saying he's impressed with the big global response to Haiti.
One of the most heartening facts in this otherwise heartbreaking story is the dimension of international response. People throughout the world want to help. One of our biggest challenges will be to help them, to help Haiti to the utmost.
To the utmost. The neighbors know it won't be easy. The president of the neighboring Dominican Republic, Leonel Fernandez, toured Haiti's capital yesterday, praised relief efforts, but said the problems won't be solved quickly.
This is not only a short-term problem. It's going to be a long-term situation for Haiti. And I think the whole international community should focus on how are we going to help Haiti be rebuilt.
And everybody can see it's going to take a long time. Let's get our callers right in here. Ike in Charleston, South Carolina. Ike, you're on the air.
Yeah, and I hope somebody important is listening to this show because I'm a former Air Force loadmaster.
Yes, sir.
Our job is to put equipment on the ground. You put a dime on the ground, I'll get a pallet on the ground. I can drop tanks. I can drop front-end loaders. I can drop heavy equipment. I can drop food. I can drop water. Here's my question. If you've got such an immediate need, you've got paratroopers that can protect the supplies, why don't you start putting that stuff on the ground and start dispersing that through that city and quit, at the very least, put the food, the water, and the medicine and drop it and get it dispersed.
Let me ask you, because you've got expertise, do you need a perfect airport to do that? Do you need a perfect port?
No, sir. You fly over, you drop it out of the back of the plane onto any surface as far as it's, as long as it's somewhat level ground, and you can disperse it. Like, for example, right there where that presidential palace is at, where all those people are at in that field.
Mm-hmm.
If you clear that field out of there, you can drop all kinds of stuff. You can drop front-end loaders, heavy equipment, generators, everything you need.
I don't
understand this. I've seen this time and again, and I don't understand. Somebody find out where the loadmasters are. Find out where the airdrops are, and if you want to get this in gear, get the loadmasters, and we'll handle it.
I appreciate your call. Deborah, yes, please.
I'm former military myself, Air Force, and I hesitated to say anything at all critical of the military because I know that they're doing
a lot.
The amazing job. I know that without being there, but I have wondered what? Where are the loadmasters and the civil engineers? I mean, when we were in the field, we used to joke, you know, if your mom sends you a box of cookies, don't put the box down because in 2 minutes they will have built a building out of it, you know?
Right.
Those guys are good, and I'm wondering, and they don't need, you know, real runways and that kind of stuff. So I agree with the caller from Charleston. I am not criticizing the military. I'm not there. I'm sitting here drinking coffee in my comfortable house.
Yep, yep.
But these guys are so good at this, and I do wonder why they can't get that stuff on the ground and get some temporary roads in and some temporary runways in. I know there's an answer, but I agree with the caller. I'm wondering.
Jack, I couldn't help wonder, what, you know, the first rescue images we saw out of our neighbor, Haiti, were Chinese relief people in orange jumpsuits with dogs coming out, you know, ready to roll. I mean, we do have a big military here. No doubt a lot of help will come, but couldn't it be a couple days faster? Couldn't we get something in those streets right now?
I feel that way. Yesterday, Tom Bowman, the Pentagon correspondent for NPR, interviewed a general at the Pentagon, someone in charge of this. And this fellow, the general, was a study in caution, in caveats, in bureaucraties. He said, we need a plan. Before we do anything, we have to have the plan, and that's going to take some time, and we have to build up. And I kept thinking, well, wait a minute, what about the psychology of the people? What about just seeing, you know, soldiers there? Wouldn't that give their hopes at least a rise? Wouldn't a candy bar here or there help? And this whole approach made me think that what the Pentagon may really be afraid of is violence, is desperate people coming at them and they're not able to protect themselves, and that there will be some horrible scenes, and which may now play out, in fact. But it seems to me by delaying longer, they've made that scenario perhaps more likely, as people desperate are going to just, you know, as soon as they see the water and the food, they're going to, you know, throng to it. And and there undoubtedly will be some crowd scenes that will be disturbing.
The danger of that violence still there. We're reading reports today of angry Port-au-Prince residents building barricades in the streets just to kind of show how upset they are. Barricades made of crumbled buildings and bodies. Alan in Farmington, Connecticut, you're on the air.
Yes. Well, I'm repeating what somebody else said, but it sounds like the government doesn't know what a parachute is. And it's not necessarily, this is not a problem with Haiti. It's a problem with our government, because this could happen in the United States somewhere, mm-hmm. where water has to get in tomorrow, and what we should have somewhere in the States are pallets of water designed to help, you know, 25,000, 50,000 people, whatever it is, 100,000, on pallets, ready to go. And that water could have been dropped in bottles,
Yeah, you'd like to think so. No doubt a lot of aid will come, but you've got to feel the urgency right now. There's a sort of political spin on this as well. Rush Limbaugh taking shots at the president early on for Obama's quick response to the Haiti earthquake, saying it was for reasons larger than just relief help.
This will play right into Obama's hands. Humanitarian, compassionate. They'll use this to burnish their credibility with the black community in both light-skinned and dark-skinned black community in this country. It's made to order for them. That's why he couldn't wait to get out there. Could not wait to get out there.
Made to order for them. Deborah Dickerson, what is that?
I have been wrestling with him and Robertson, and I cannot make heads or both the light skin and the dark skin. It wasn't crazy enough, but then he had to. It makes no sense. And I think this plays into the whole teabag Obama isn't a citizen thing. There are certain people who just cannot bear the fact that, A, Democrats are in power, and, B, that a black person is president of the United States. If you know my work, you know I'm not one of these people that thinks everything is racism. But these kinds of comments, and Haiti made a pact with the devil.
That was Pat Robertson saying way back when it fought for its independence, it made a pact.
But the way he phrased it, not to get out from under slavery, but to come from under the heel of the French, they made a pact with the devil. There is some serious
all the worst
psychology. This is overt, and I would think even their most rabid followers, if they're not given pause by these kind of statements, I think it's probably a good thing. When somebody says this kind of thing out loud, and clearly Limbaugh and Robertson live in a kind of bubble where no one that they disagree with can get in there, it's good, I think, for their followers to hear this kind of stuff, because there is no way to describe this except racism that has driven people to the point of lunacy.
Let's get a call from Reggie, Meridian, Mississippi. Reggie, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. How are you folks doing?
We're all right, Reggie. What do you know?
Good. I wanted to make a comment first to the callers that's calling and blaming the United States government. First off, it's not the American government. The American government, you know, yeah, there's things that have been done in the past, but in this tragedy right now, they're actually doing as much as they possibly can. I'm a Haitian American. I was actually born in Haiti.
Yep.
And I've been in here since I've been in the States ever since I was about 13 years old. I joined the military. I was an airborne soldier, just an airborne officer when I graduated from Florida Memorial University. Then I went to the Army. I became a second lieutenant. I've been in until 2006 is when I came out. But you can't take, you know, pick up the whole military or a whole brigade and take them to Haiti and just say, well, after an earthquake finish happening, and then you just says, well, this is what we're going to do. We're just going to drop food.
Yep.
You have to come up with a plan. You have to come up with a plan. You have to make sure that the rescuer themselves doesn't become victim, you know, when they go down there. I mean, how devastating would that be? You show up with 2,000 soldiers, and then you got a mob of 100,000 people just come and trying to take them, then these soldiers forgot.
Reggie, it's a very level-headed and practical point, and we take it fully on board. I mean, we remember back in the Clinton years when the U.S. military, you know, got to the pier in Haiti and turned around. Nobody liked that. Aiken, South Carolina. Brenda, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
The most important story of the week that I'm not hearing, we have this stark contrast between these bank CEOs up on Capitol Hill begging for business as usual and trying, wanting to keep their bonuses and everything. And then we have these desperately poor people in Haiti and this horrendous calamity. The story I'm not hearing and would like to hear is for these CEOs to donate their bonuses to the relief effort.
That could go a long, long way, given the size. We're reading maybe $140 billion in compensation there in total. Brenda, thanks for that call. President Obama talking this week about clawing back from the banking industry. Zanny, I'll come to you on this. Here he was, this was yesterday, the president proposing a $100 billion-plus tax on banks levied on top financial firms to get back some of the bailout money. Didn't talk about Haiti, but bailout money.
We want our money back, and we're going to get it. And that's why I'm proposing a financial crisis responsibility fee to be imposed on major financial firms until the American people are fully compensated for the extraordinary assistance they provided to Wall Street.
Now, it was all the rougher against the backdrop of Haiti. It's true. Zanny Mittenbettos, you know, you've seen the reports coming out today. J.P. Morgan reporting its profits and what's set aside for compensation and bonuses. President called some of these bonuses obscene. Do you hear a gear shift in the relationship between Washington and Wall Street this week, Zanny, or just a lot of noise?
I think there's a lot of noise, but I do think it's symptomatic of a very real anger, and I think the administration is, with this proposal, this financial crisis responsibility fee, is trying to respond to the popular anger about these huge bonuses at the same time as 10% of Americans have no job. And at the same time, they're trying to do it in a way that makes economic sense. So they're trying to assuage anger, but not be kind of retributionist in a way that would not make economic sense. And this fee, this tax, actually pretty ably straddles those two things, because it's in fact economically quite sensible. They've couched it in this tone of populism of we want our money back.
And Jack, what about the bigger picture? Watching the bank chiefs this week before this commission, supposed to be kind of like the PCORA commission back in the 1930s. Hot seat was the framing for it. We used it ourselves, but you know, the more I looked at it this week, the less hot that seat actually looked.
Indeed. And they didn't cut a very impressive figure, I must say. Whoever their PR man or firms were, they didn't prep them. They weren't speaking to real people. They were speaking in the jargon of their business. And it was clear, and in fact, they almost said, we didn't quite know what we were doing. And, you know, in The New Yorker last week, a University of Chicago economist said flat out, University of Chicago, I emphasize, said flat out, these people were either greedy or stupid or possibly both. And for that, the whole country is suffering. For that, dreams are dying all over this country. And the question is, how can they be made to answer? And I'm just sorry that the administration, through the guidance of Larry Summers and Tim Geithner, is not going on along with what the Europeans want to do, which is to have a transactions tax, a Tobin tax, on speculation that would effectively put a sort of breaker even within the incentive system on Wall Street and raise a heck of a lot of money. I was hoping for something like that. Delusionally, I was hoping for maybe even antitrust action against some of these big firms. Neither of those things are in the offing.
Zanny Minton-Beddoes, what about those two? Transaction tax in Europe, should that work here?
Well, the administration looked at that and they decided, and I think rightly, that it was actually it was both inefficient, not effective, and it wouldn't have the kind of impact that people wanted. I mean, what a transaction tax would do would be to dry up liquid markets. It would do nothing to reduce risk-taking. It would do nothing to reduce bank size or try and have some kind of tax that encouraged banks.
Why is Europe doing it?
Europe is not actually doing it. It's been discussed in Europe. What's in fact happened in Europe and what the British have done is to impose a one-off tax on bank bonus pools.
Mm-hmm.
That's different to the U.S. proposal. What the British government said was it is obscene that there are these huge bonuses being paid this year on the back of our
bailout.
And mm-hmm. so we want to tax some of that back.
What rate?
It's a 50% tax. The question is how much money will it actually raise, because banks are extremely clever at getting around it.
Yeah.
But it is seen very much as a kind of one-off windfall tax. Where I think the administration's proposal is actually very sensible in economic terms is that this is saying big institutions that raise money from the capital market, so not from depositors. If you have deposits, you're already paying into the FDIC if you're a bank. You're already kind of paying for the implicit protection of deposit insurance. But if you're raising money from the capital markets, if you're levered, you get an implicit subsidy now because you get bailed out if you get into trouble. And what this responsibility mm-hmm. fee is really trying to do is to get some payment for that subsidy. And what surprised me is that they've couched it in terms of only doing it for 10 years. If it's a sensible idea, then it should be there permanently. And if what it does is discourage banks from getting too big, then that's probably no bad thing for the financial system overall.
And what about the bonuses themselves, Deborah Dickerson? You know, the argument gets made again and again. These are basically bonuses paid by American taxpayers, in effect. Without that taxpayer support, none of it would be there. It's headed into the bankers' pockets. Obama's talking tough about it, but do you think he's doing enough to assuage popular anger about it?
I'm not sure what he could do to assuage popular anger over it. I'm nobody's economist, but it is the fact of what they've done to this economy, given the mortgage crisis, all the massive loss of jobs, loss of homes, people living in their cars, then they get bailed out, then they get bonuses. I don't know what he could do. That absolutely, the bonus situation, it almost makes me incoherent that someone could do, organizations could behave the way that these have, and that there's even a discussion. I don't care what their contract said. I'm sure their contracts also said, and by the way, you won't run the economy into the ground. They probably didn't think that needed saying. If these bonuses happen any time before the economy is normal people feel like they're starting to get a hold back on reality.
And they are happening before that. They're happening right now. They're starting today.
Exactly. So it really makes me kind of incoherent. It's unbelievable that this is even on the table. And given the extraordinary circumstances, like, you know, the simple fact of what you've done to the economy, the world economy and the national economy, and you still demand your bonus.
Watch out.
And they're probably going to get away with it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Bob Costas with the MLB Network interviewed baseball home run giant Mark McGwire about his now admitted steroid use at the height of his big career.
I wish it never came into my life, but we're sitting here talking about it. And I'm so sorry that I have to. And I apologize to everybody in Major League Baseball.
Yeah, late-night TV battles. NBC is reportedly close to moving Jay Leno back to the 11:35 time slot. What happens to Conan O'Brien? Here he is.
And I just want to say to the kids out there watching, you can do anything you want in life. Yeah. Yeah, unless Jay Leno wants to do it too.
Oh, and R&B legend Teddy Pendergrass died of complications from colon cancer. He was 59. Here he is with Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes in 1972. Zanny Mittenbeddows is with us from The Economist. Deborah Dickerson from Mother Jones and Jack Beatty is here. You've still got a lot of callers on bankers. Scott, Nashua, New Hampshire. You're on the air, Scott.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think one thing that hasn't been discussed is with all this money that these guys can throw around to pay themselves these enormous bonuses, you got to wonder where these profits are coming from, where all this excess money is coming from. And one of the implications is that somebody is being overcharged. Somebody is charging too much for services. And so, for example, I look at the letters I receive from the credit card companies saying, because of the current business climate, your interest rates are being raised. Nothing that I had to do with it, but because of the current business climate. I think we need to look at our usury laws and rethink what is acceptable in terms of the profits that are being generated here.
Scott, let us pick it up. Because Zanny, I mean, one thing we see, the profits are very large, but the profits from consumer business, despite jacking up credit card rates, are not there. In fact, the banks have seen losses there, Zanny. There's a kind of decoupling of the consumer economy and the finance economy.
That's right. A lot of these profits are coming because the banks can borrow very cheaply, practically at zero from the Fed, and then invest in, you know, riskier assets, all of which have boomed this year. I think it makes a bit of a mockery of the idea that the bank's profits are all of their own work. And I think the bankers, frankly, have themselves to blame for this popular backlash. But that said, I just wanted to come back to a point that Deborah made before the break. And I'm worried about the kind of extent of stoking up this popular backlash. Clearly, the bankers have themselves to blame, and I'm not defending kind of these bonuses in any way, but I do think it's very, very dangerous to have policy made on the basis of anger. I think tax policy as punishment is extremely dangerous. And I think we need to kind of think of the broader economy. What's going to help the 10% of Americans who have no job most is the economy recovering, and that's going to require lending. And that's going to require healthy financial institutions. It doesn't mean banks paying themselves enormous bonuses, but it does mean that we have to be careful about this notion that we want to really pound on Wall Street and that we really want to kind of extract every last bit of punishment from these guys.
But it seems so far from every last bit of punishment, Zanny, when $140 billion is set aside in compensation. I mean, I think a lot of Americans are still wondering, are we really supposed to just kind of go back to what we were doing before when that flamed out so dramatically?
Absolutely. And we absolutely need financial reform. We need quite serious regulatory reform. And that's why I think this proposal, this responsibility fee, is actually pretty sensible. It's not. If you took away the kind of the angry rationale for it, it's actually just as a piece of tax policy, I think it makes sense. And I think it makes sense to have it permanently, not just for a few years.
But there certainly was not.
I think we have to differentiate, Deborah, between teabag anger and
Tea Party
righteous anger. Mm-hmm. And I think people wouldn't be so angry if $140 billion in bonuses wasn't on the table. And I think they're also, people need to know in the banking industry that this can never happen again. And I think they need to understand that there are some times when the popular response it needs to be there. People need to know what they can and cannot get away with.
That's absolutely right, Deborah. But at the same time, we need to make sure, at least policymakers need to make sure, that the populist anger doesn't result in policies which, in fact, will hurt ordinary Americans by slowing down the recovery, by slowing down lending. And there's a very careful balance there.
We heard, you know, from at least one of these CEOs this week that, hey, you know, this happens every 5 to 7 years. That doesn't sound like something that will never happen again. And here's, I've got a little tape of the chairman of Goldman Sachs, Lloyd Blankfein, saying, yeah, he didn't really apologize for what happened. He wished things would have been different, but it's so wishy-washy.
Anyone who says, I wouldn't change a thing, I think is crazy. Of course I'd go back and wish we had done whatever it took not to be in the position that we find ourselves.
Jack, I still see that. I think, you know, Zanny's right. You've got to be careful. But this is political dynamite on the table, and it seems to cut in all kinds of interesting ways. You know, people on the left unhappy about it, people on the right unhappy about it. We had a quite hot hour with the Tea Party people on the show this week, and lots of response to that. But, you know, they're upset in part at Wall Street, but it's the same Wall Street that's also putting money in, you know, Democrat and Republican pockets.
Oh, it is indeed. It is a fact, I believe, that Barack Obama's single largest contributor, when you factor everything in, was the Goldman Sachs company. And the Democrats were able to take Congress, the Senate, in 2006, partly, in no small part, on money raised from Wall Street. And now we read in this morning's paper that Chris Dodd may be willing to drop the Consumer Protection Agency. That was going to be part of the House reform.
To be fair, Republicans pushing very hard for that to be dropped. Republicans not at all on board with the
regulation. Oh, no, Republicans are completely – that's right. But he's willing to drop that in order to reach a deal with them. And, of course, dropping that is precisely what the banks want. The banks who were, you know, as you say, were they contrite or were they just muddled? I couldn't tell. But they are lobbying fiercely and exorbitantly, even yet, on Capitol Hill to kill the reform, to prevent them from doing what they just did to the whole economy. You know, you talk about anger. In the National Journal this morning, who benefits most? A poll. Who do you think has benefited most from the federal government's response to the financial crisis over the last 12 months? The public says by 40%, banks and investment companies. Middle class, 9%. Low-income individuals, 8%. That's poison. And I think what we see now with David Axelrod has been putting this line out. It's now in the Massachusetts Senate campaign in ads from Martha Coakley. They're going to it may be bad policy. I don't think it is at all, by the way, to be tough on Wall Street. But it is now going to be Democratic politics to hit at this constantly and to identify the GOP with the status quo on Wall Street and to have the Obama administration fronted probably by Tim Geithner, a creature of Wall Street, and Lawrence Summers, a friend, they're going to come out strongly populistic.
I'm not sure who's going to carry Wall Street on the shoulder. Dan in Newton, Massachusetts, you're on the air, Dan.
Yeah, hi all, and it's an honor to speak to you, Tom. It seems to me like everybody's trying to scramble now sort of after the fact to figure out how we can recoup some of the money, how we can tease some of the anger. And I'm wondering, why wasn't more done right at the outset when we were bailing out these banks to figure out, look, if we're saving your lives, if we're covering the downside for you, if we're doing something that they would never do for me as a personal investor, you know, if I invested with them, I lose money, I lost it. If we're saving the lives of their companies, why didn't we structure it so that we would participate in the upside, let's say for 10 years? You know, so this year maybe we say, look, if you give bonuses, half of what you give as bonuses has to go back to America.
Dan, that is in part exactly what the White House has suggested here, that this new fee could be paid out of the bonus pool. No big cheer from Wall Street for that. Thank you. Richard, Framingham, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Richard.
Yeah, I took economics at the University of Chicago, and no doubt some of my professors will start grinding their teeth when they hear this, but they didn't really talk about how our free market system would protect against plutocracy. And the only defense I see against plutocracy is aggressive taxation against those who are benefiting from it. And I'd be interested to hear the commentator's remarks on that.
Plutocracy, it looks something like that in those numbers. I don't know, Deborah, do you see groundswell for aggressive taxation? Are people falling enough out of the gravy train that they're willing to, you know, go after them that's got?
Americans, it's amazing. It doesn't really matter the income level. Americans are not big fans of high taxes. I think because so many of us think one day I'm going to be a millionaire and I don't want to have to pay high taxes. I don't see Americans pushing in that direction, except maybe on like these bonuses and bailout money and that sort of thing. But you know, this is more of an economist type question. I'm nobody's economist.
Let me take it to the economist and Zanny. Zanny, let me ask you this: Do you know one way is to go in and change policy around Wall Street to defuse this anger? Another way is to get the economy back up and jobs back up. Do you see that coming, Zanny?
Well, unfortunately, I'm worried that the economic recovery is going to be sufficiently fragile that the jobless rate is not going to come down fast enough to assuage this very real sense of anger in the country. We had, in the aftermath of the last two recessions, which were very mild recessions, we had what was called the jobless recovery. You know, the economy was growing, but there were no jobs. And I'm increasingly worried that we're going to see that again. And when you've got unemployment at 10%, that's an extremely scary outlook. It has very huge human costs, but politically it means that this environment of anger is not going to disappear anytime soon. So I think we had, you know, last year was very scary in the sense that we were really on the edge of an economic abyss. And for all the complaints about how, you know, the banks were treated, I think if we had not had the support that Wall Street had, we would have been in an economic abyss. And I think it's very striking. One poll shows now that over 60% of Americans think bailing out the banks was a mistake. If we hadn't had that government response, I think we would have been in much worse shape. That's not to say that it couldn't have been better structured. And I think the caller who suggested that it's with hindsight, too little was done to give the taxpayer upside, I think that's probably true. But now as we go forward, we're in an environment where the economy is no longer shrinking, but we're not in any kind of vigorous rebound. And so that's really, really tricky politically. And how you manage economic policy to avoid, in my view, kind of dangerous populist reactions at the same time as needing and to assuage these very real anger out there, that's going to be a balancing act that I think this administration is going to have to walk for quite a long time.
That's a hot wire. Taxes coming on another front this week, the beginning of the week. We heard pushback from the president of the AFL-CIO, Richard Trumka, at the National Press Club, saying that, you know, taxing Cadillac health care plans would be a huge burden to the middle class. Let's listen.
The bill rightfully seeks to ensure that most Americans have health insurance. But instead of taxing the rich, the Senate bill taxes the middle class by taxing workers' health plans, not just union members' health care plans. In fact, most of the 31 million uninsured or insured employees who will be hit by the excise tax are not union members.
But it would include union members, or would have, Jack, a late-night agreement last night between the White House and senators and representatives appears to have come over this hump. I started out thinking Cadillac health plans would be for those CEOs, but it turns out a lot of union members would have qualified, and some kind of compromise has been reached here.
Yes, it has. The original Senate bill called for a tax of 40% on the value of employer-sponsored health coverage exceeding $8,500 a year for individuals and $23,000 a year for a family. Pretty good plans. This current compromise now has put the individual level at $8,900 and the family at $24,000, and it has delayed the implementation of this tax until 2000 for union members, for people whose contracts are running, until 2018, which is 5 years beyond the date most other people will feel it. So it is a sop to organized labor, and the Republicans are depicting it that way. On the other hand, we know that union contracts often, in those contracts, members receive their compensation in the form of the health benefit, and so they essentially have foregone raises in order to get these benefits, and to have
in
them
the past
taxed seems to be just cruel. Certainly, the idea of a steel worker having to pay taxes on his health benefits.
Of course, they could be pretty big, and political clout carried the day. There's Robert in Nashville. You're on the air, Robert.
Good morning, everybody. I just wanted to have a quick question about Harry Reid, and if you could respond to how this is going to impact the Democratic Party or the politics in the Senate
if Harry Reid does not make it back.
Harry Reid and his comments about the president that came out in a book this week, that he had assessed him earlier on in the campaign season as a good candidate because he was a, quote, light-skinned African-American with, quote, no Negro dialect. This was President Obama's response on that.
For him to have used some inartful language in trying to praise me and for people to try to make hay out of that makes absolutely no sense.
Deborah Dickerson, my good African-American countrywoman, what did you make of Harry Reid's phrasing?
And wouldn't you like to know if I was light-skinned or dark-skinned?
Hey, it's all the same to me.
You know, only in America would something like this be taking up our time. He was, that was analysis. That was not racism. And what his analysis was absolutely correct. You know, it's Michael Kinsley's famous formulation about a gaffe is when the truth slips out, you know. And he's absolutely right. I'm on record as having said repeatedly throughout the campaign that if he had been Raheem Jackson from Detroit with the exact same resume, but with, you know, dreadlocks, and spoke like Jesse Jackson, none of us would know his name today. So Harry Reid said what is obviously true, and we're wasting valuable time when we've got so many real problems in this country. And the use of the term Negro is an older guy trying to figure out which term is inoffensive. So the whole thing is just really silly.
Is Negro now on a no-no list, Deborah?
I use the term Negro all the time, mostly because I find it amusing. Negro is just a very old-fashioned term, and I think the people who are trying to take offense at it, in the Black blogosphere this week, there's a whole thing about how Negro is a box you can check on the census.
Yes, indeed.
Please. No, Negro is not a bad term, but hey, who needs the trouble? Just say Black or African-American.
Yeah, and on we roll. We'll see what the fallout is for Harry Reid. Deborah Dickerson with Mother Jones, it's great to have you with us. Thank you very much for joining us today, Deborah.
No, I had fun. Thank you.
And Zanny Minton-Beddoes, Global Economics Editor for The Economist magazine, joining us from Washington. Thank you, Zanny.
My pleasure.
Jack Beatty, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Mm-hmm.